Sidney Albright.
A total of 10 Japanese planes were destroyed in yesterday's operations, according to the latest communique issued by Allied General Headquarters. At Rabaul, New Britain, our Air Force attacked shipping in the harbor, damaging a transport, when 17 enemy fighters intercepted our planes. The communique modestly says of the ensuing battle, our fighters were intercepted by 17 enemy fighters, 7 of which were shot down. All our planes returned from this raid. Port Moresby, New Guinea, was twice attacked by enemy aircraft. 13 fighters machine-gunned the airdrome in the first raid, 26 heavy bombers, escorted by 9 fighters, attacked shipping in the harbor in the second raid. Allied defenders shot down 2 enemy fighters. The Japanese seaplane base on Devoyne Island was the scene of another attack by our Air Force. 1 seaplane was sunk, and fires were started on the ground installations. Australians view with ever-increasing concern the frequent reports reaching here from Allied capitals that Hitler is enemy number one, and that the Pacific theater of war is of secondary importance. An excellent editorial dealing with this subject appeared today in one of Sydney's leading newspapers. It is well worth quoting in full. It says, nobody believes that the Battle of the Coral Sea is decisive. Japan, with naval forces superior in number to those of the Allied nations in the Pacific, and concentrated within easy operating range of its many bases, both home and captured, will hardly accept this reverse as final. Rather, it will tend to make the Japanese realize the menace of American-Australian cooperation and its growing strength, and seek, therefore, to destroy it at all costs. Already there are reports of large Japanese concentrations behind the screen of captured islands and archipelagos to the north. It is of vital interest, therefore, to consider the attitude of the political and military authorities of the United States of America. Do these envisage the Coral Sea action as the beginning of the Allied offensive in the Southwest Pacific? Correspondents in touch with these authorities threw more than a little doubt upon their attitude. The United States has an enormous job to face. There are priorities to Britain and Russia in the delivery of raw materials, and the Atlantic must be held against the growing menace of the U-boat. In spite of the fact that America has given hostages to fortune in the many gallant American airmen, soldiers, and sailors on the Southwest Pacific, American eyes still see Hitler as the chief and immediate menace. According to the view of Australian correspondents in America, there is a lack, intent, at present, to join decisive issue with Japan in the Southwest Pacific theater. This means that the United States High Command, now needing any renewal of Japanese attacks, considers that a full offensive is not yet practicable, but proposes to go on with a steady reinforcement in order to fill the Australasian area as a base for such operations in the future. Yet, if while American and British eyes are focused on Europe, the South Pacific situation gets out of hand, and the Japanese are able to cut the U.S. Australian communications or capture the remaining bases in the Australasian region, a problem of attack from Hawaii on the Japanese naval forces will be one to tax even the combined navies of Britain and the USA. In such an event, Hawaii itself may be so pressed that the battles for sea supremacy would have to be kept close to the American coast, and the war with Japan drag on for years in a slow process of winning back what was lost. The Allied nations cannot afford to regard this area as one of anything but the most vital importance. The Japanese have no illusions about it. I now return you to San Francisco.
For further reports, we call in the newsroom in New York.
This is New York, and next, news of Great Britain, as reported direct from London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. The British are watching closely the reports of the fighting on the Russian front. But about the only thing military circles in London had to say today was that there's no evidence for reports that the Russians have opened up one extended front from Leningrad to Kharkov. Yesterday, I went to the housewarming luncheon of a new club in London. It's a club for the fighting men, the diplomats, and the civilians of the allied countries. A place where they can meet and swap ideas over a meal or a glass of beer. London, the center of the governments of most of Europe, has become probably the most cosmopolitan city of the world in the last couple of years. The fact struck you with some force at that Allies Club luncheon. Ambassador Biddle, the American envoy to the allied governments, had taken a table at the housewarming. Looking around the table, you saw Americans, a Norwegian, a Belgian, a Russian, a Pole, a Czech, a Dutchman, a Greek, and a Frenchman. A South African Boer rubbed shoulders with an Englishman, and a Yugoslav. A Canadian was talking with a Chinese. A Greek, who talked English with an accent that was pure New York, leaned over and said, "I think this is a good thing. You can't beat personal contacts. Look around this table. Someday every one of the men at the table will be holding a position of some sort of influence in his own country." The Greek said, "Who can tell, but someday the fact that we've met each other and talked today may do away with some international misunderstanding. Who can tell that what the fact that we meet now as friends and equals over a good meal may stop a war in Asia or a boundary dispute in Czechoslovakia 20 years from now?" It was an interesting speculation. He wondered whether the free French aviator talking with the elderly New Zealand woman or the Polish officer talking with the American would learn something from a completely foreign view of life that might someday help a bit toward that vague thing called international understanding, which is, after all, nothing more than a lot of people realizing that the whole world is linked together for better or worse in one common humanity. These Frenchmen, Dutchmen, Serbs have learned that there's no such thing as isolation from the rest of the world, but the viewpoint of the countryman who said to his pal when he saw a man from the next village, "Here's a stranger, Joe, heave half a brick at him," well, that viewpoint just isn't good enough anymore. The English, too, are fast learning that no nation stands alone in a vacuum, and the fact that a Pole may marry a Scotch girl, or a Cockney rear gunner may be treated to a cigarette and some new ideas by a French sailor, is helping Britain's education. And if that Allies Club in London can convince Americans or Russians or Belgians that there are many interesting and good and valuable things that they can learn from the peoples of foreign countries, then the Greek may have been right when he said it all may stop a war in Asia or a boundary dispute in Central Europe 20 years from now. Some of the men who took part in the raids on Rostock and other places in Germany have just been given awards for bravery. Here is one of them, Flight Sergeant Kerr. He was the rear gunner of a plane that attacked the Heinkel Works at Rostock. As the plane left the target area, a Nazi fighter swooped in the bomber from close range. It looked as though the German couldn't miss. But hunched up in his little rear gunner's cabin, Flight Sergeant Kerr sent a stream of bullets into the German plane at just the right split second. The Nazi craft caught fire and exploded in midair. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Our next report from Scandinavia. Go ahead, Stockholm.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. It is becoming more apparent in this northern capital that the Germans are trying to throw off a smokescreen as to the real intentions. Berlin reports during the past few days have perhaps been aimed at adding to this confusion. What do the Germans say? In the first place, they are trying to impress the foreign correspondents with a potential strength. They are constantly speaking of new additions to the lines of weapons and increased armor from those already in use. Chief among these claims are those of their secret weapons. But when a Swedish correspondent reiterated the statements of the German spokesman as to the kind of, quote, nerve gas, unquote, this correspondent was hastily given his exit papers. At the same time, a Swede who had served with the German army as a volunteer says that this new secret weapon is an air torpedo. Fired from a special gun, it is filled with compressed air and other ingredients which increase the air pressure to such an extent that the lungs burst. Its effects range somewhere over 400 yards, he says. Secondly, German reports today are saying that the German transportation system is once more functioning normally, and this is interpreted by the reports as meaning that the German troop concentrations have now been completed. Thirdly, Swedish correspondents in Berlin have reflected the German high command opinion that when the spring offensive begins, it will begin on all fronts. Swedish military correspondents, on the other hand, doubt that this would be possible, since it would not lead to a sufficient concentration of power. Then, too, last night a DNB report stated that the Germans would strike where the enemy would least expect it. Fourthly, Berlin rumor has it that large German troop concentrations have been moved up to the Western Front, presumably as a threat of invasion of the British Isles. What is to be interpreted from the confusion of reports which come out of Berlin today? Either they are trying to hide their real intentions behind high-sounding phrases, or else they are trying to increase the morale of their own people. After all, the smokescreen could serve the double purpose of confusing the enemy and of convincing the people at home that new strength derived from mysterious arms, has placed final victory within grasp. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
Now here's the report of Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. This is the 24th birthday of the Airmail Postal Service, and as a birthday present, the Army takes over the commercial air service in the United States of America, and airmail service may be curtailed for the war. Anyhow, there's no doubt that commercial and private passenger service is a thing of the past, except in emergencies for war need. At least one half the passenger planes go into the Army use now, so they say here, and if you want an air ride, you've got to prove to a hard-boiled Army that your presence in an airplane is helpful to the successful prosecution of the war. And within a few days, the Senate of the United States will be given a picture of waste and duplication of effort and unnecessary spending, which may result in further government economies or some less appropriations. The report on waste in government and duplication of effort now being prepared by Senator Millard Tidings of Maryland, who's chairman of the committee. The report will be given to the appropriating committees of Congress, so it will be their guide in cutting out extravagances and unnecessary activities in government and streamlining some of these bureaus. The reason these things grow up and continue is because in the lush times of peace, almost anything goes. One extravagance, I believe, is the unlimited and unrestrained use of automobiles and gasoline by government bureaus here in Washington that I know about. None of the B and X cards, which are making so much of a furor, are government cars or officials. No, I shouldn't say that. They're not for the personal use. The government and official cars have no restraint. No cards being necessary. There's no ration on government cars or drivers so far. Those congressional cars were private cars. Nor is there any attempt so far to organize a government transportation service. Every office has its own car and chauffeur, cars and chauffeurs, whereas tens of thousands of gallons and tens of thousands of dollars could be saved by establishing one central government system for the use of cars in the delivery of messages and material. Messenger service, riding hither and yon on really necessary business, is okay, but you'll find practically every government messenger riding with four or five empty seats. Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau has suggested a neat way of raising an extra $5 from everybody who files an income tax return. So that would go as far down as the $9 or $10 a week boys who make a return, of course, but don't pay a tax. Even though you don't have to pay a tax, they would have what Morgenthau is now calling an examination fee, just for the privilege of making out the papers. That is one substitute for the sales tax, in a sense, because it gets a federal tax down about as far down in the income class as you can get in this country. The fuel situation in New England is very serious, they tell me this morning. The government may subsidize coal shipments to New England so that in that corner of the country, fuel prices can be held down. And here's the Japanese beetle, which ravages plant life in the United States, is said to be as dangerous as Japanese bullets by Senator Russell of Florida, who wants to raise $500,000 to fight the bug, and that's all from Washington at this time.
And that's the up-to-the-minute news of the world. The staff members reporting to you are Sidney Albright from Australia, John McVane from London, David Anderson from Stockholm, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.